Imagine, just for a second, the heaviest debt you could possibly carry.
Oh, man.
Right. And I am not talking about a financial one here, not like a massive underwater mortgage or, you know, a mountain medical bills. I want you to imagine a moral debt.
Yeah, a spiritual one.
Exactly. The kind of really profound, lingering guilt that just keeps you awake at 3 in the morning, staring at the ceiling, replaying your worst moments, and wondering, you know, how could I ever possibly make this right? How do you balance cosmic scales when you are the one who tipped them?
It is, it's a genuinely overwhelming thought, because unlike financial debt, there is no bankruptcy court for the human soul.
Yeah, you can't just declare Chapter 11 on your conscience.
No, you really can't. There's no clear worldly payment plan you can negotiate to just wipe the slate clean when you're dealing with that profound sense of moral bankruptcy. We try to apologize, we try to volunteer, we overcorrect, but that internal ledger often just still feels totally out of balance.
And that incredibly heavy, deeply human instinct to just try and balance the scales is exactly what we are unpacking today. We are doing a deep dive into a theological source document from Bible Life Overcomers Ministry, and it is titled, Jesus Paid It All.
It's a fascinating text.
It really is. And our mission today is to completely dissect the Christian concept of redemption as it is presented in this document. We are going to analyze exactly what it means to be bought with a price.
Yeah.
And why this specific worldview absolutely insists that human efforts, no matter how noble or exhausting they are, can never actually foot the bill for that spiritual debt.
Right. And just to set the stage for you, as we go through this material, we aren't just looking at, you know, general religious tradition today. We are analyzing a very specific, highly structured argument about how the universe actually manages its moral economy.
The mechanics of it.
Exactly. The document lays out this profound framework of justice, of mercy, and of a radical change of ownership. It fundamentally challenges our basic assumptions about what constitutes valid currency in the realm of morality.
Which brings us right to the foundation of the author's argument. The document enthusiastically lays out this massive contrast between what it calls corruptible things, like silver and gold, versus the precious blood of Christ.
It completely flips how we normally think about value.
It really does.
Yeah.
But before we get to the payment, I think we need to understand the crisis itself. Like, why is a payment of that specific extreme magnitude needed in the first place?
Well, to understand the payment, you first have to understand the nature of the debt, right? Mm-hmm. And the actual condition of the debtor. We have to look at the economics of redemption as this framework defines it.
Okay, so define redemption for us in this context.
So the word redeem literally means to buy back or to release someone by paying a ransom price. In the logic of this source, redemption isn't just, you know, getting a second chance. It includes three distinct simultaneous actions.
Which are?
A rescue from bondage, a release from legal guilt, and a total transfer into a completely new ownership.
Let's unpack that first part, the rescue from bondage. Because the word redemption gets thrown around a lot in pop culture, right? Like redeeming a coupon at the grocery store, or a villain in a movie having a redemption arc where they just, I don't know, decide to start being nice.
Right, like they just change their mind.
Yeah, but this document uses it in a much more severe, almost like a hostage situation sense. The argument is that a person isn't just uninformed or merely making bad choices. They are actively held under the power of darkness, legally guilty, and entirely unable to negotiate their own release.
The psychological insight embedded in this theology is actually really fascinating. The author points out that sin or moral failure often presents itself to us as the ultimate freedom.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it whispers that modern mantra of, you know, do whatever you want, answer to no one, be your own master.
But the underlying assumption here is that human autonomy is basically an illusion.
Precisely. The argument is that while rebelling against moral laws promises you autonomy, it actually corrupts human desire. It weakens your willpower, darkens your understanding, and ultimately results in a form of behavioral and spiritual bondage.
So you think you're in charge?
Right. You think you are the master of your choices, but you actually become a slave to your own compulsions, your pride, or your destructive habits. The supposed freedom just becomes a cage.
I mean, I see that play out constantly in how we try to manage our own guilt. The very human tendency is to try and handle our own moral failings internally.
Oh, absolutely.
We promise ourselves we will stop, but we return to the habit. We hide the behavior from our friends. We rename it to make it sound less aggressive, you know, like it's not lying, it's managing the optics.
Managing the optics, exactly.
Right. We excuse it, or my personal favorite tactic, we compare ourselves to someone who's doing something way worse just to feel better by proxy.
Yeah.
Like, sure, I was cruel to my spouse, but at least I didn't rob a bank.
We are constantly trying to plea bargain our own guilt down to a lesser charge. But the framework makes a really crucial point here. Mere advice cannot fix this condition.
What do you mean by advice?
Like, giving a hopelessly indebted person financial advice might show them where they went wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it might teach them what good accounting looks like, but it doesn't actually put money in their bank account to pay the debt. Advice cannot break a chain. You need an actual intervention of capital.
So, feeling that pressure, we naturally try to pay it off ourselves. We try to use human currency to settle a spiritual debt.
Yeah.
The document mentions literal wealth, like silver and gold or, you know, religious donations. But it also emphasizes human effort, relying on personal morality, fasting, going to church, volunteering, or just trying to be a good person.
And the author is emphatic that those currencies are completely void in this specific transaction. The core argument here is that no person can redeem their brother or give the divine judge a ransom for them.
The price is just too high.
The price is simply beyond human wealth or human effort. You cannot place the creator of the universe in your debt by being well-behaved.
It's like trying to pay off this kind of cosmic spiritual guilt with good deeds or donations feels like trying to pay off a $1 million mortgage using Monopoly money.
Monopoly money,
right?
Yeah.
You could confidently walk into the bank and stack neon-colored Monopoly money all over the loan officer's desk. You could bring in wheelbarrows of the stuff. You could be the hardest-working Monopoly money gatherer in the entire city. But the bank officer is just going to stare at you.
They're going to call security.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter how much you have. It is the wrong currency entirely. It has zero purchasing power in that specific economy.
That analogy perfectly visualizes the dilemma the author is highlighting. The currency of human effort is fundamentally incompatible with the debt of divine justice. The two systems just do not exchange.
I have to pause this right here, though, because the mechanics of this are where a lot of people just hit a brick wall. If we are completely bankrupt in this specific economy, and our monopoly money is completely useless, who exactly holds the power to pay? Like, how does the physics of this spiritual economy actually work? If I lie, or steal, or hurt someone, how does a historical figure dying on a cross balance my specific ledger?
It's a great question.
The math there just feels incredibly disconnected to the modern mind.
That is the crucial hurdle in understanding this theology. Since human currency is void, the conversation naturally shifts to the specific currency the document says is required. The author's premise relies entirely on the concept of a perfect substitution. The required currency is identified as the lamb without blemish.
Okay, let's explore that. The argument is that Jesus is uniquely qualified to be this payment. He isn't just a very wise teacher or a good guy. The document describes him as having done no sin, with no deceit in his mouth. He is the only one holding the correct currency.
Right. And to grasp the mechanics, we have to look at the historical context the author relies on. The document references the ancient system of animal sacrifices, the blood of bulls and goats in the Old Testament. It categorizes those ancient rituals as mere shadows.
Wait, shadows of what? Like, why even have them if they didn't work?
Think of them as a daily visceral object lesson. In this worldview, those sacrifices taught the ancient people the deadly serious nature of sin. They demonstrated that moral corruption brings death. However, the author argues they could never finally take away guilt because an animal is not a true substitute for a human.
It's a different category of being.
Exactly. They just pointed forward to the reality, the ultimate fulfillment, which is a perfect, willing human substitute.
But I want to push back on the violence of this whole setup.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people look at this framework, which heavily emphasizes God's absolute holiness and strict justice, and they think, well, does this mean God just delights in suffering? Is he just an angry deity demanding a pound of flesh before he calms down and decides to be nice to us? It can sound a bit like cosmic child abuse.
Yeah, and the source document actually anticipates that exact friction. The text explicitly counters that idea, stating that God has no pleasure in wickedness or suffering. The philosophical framework here is that a truly just judge cannot look at profound evil, corruption, and abuse in the world and just say, don't worry about it. I forgive everyone.
Because that's not justice.
Right. That wouldn't be loving. It would be a total corruption of justice. It would invalidate the pain of victims. So the argument proposes that justice and mercy meet at the cross. The divine judge doesn't abandon his righteousness to save people. He saves them through a righteous sacrifice.
And crucially, it wasn't a forced sacrifice.
That is the absolute linchpin of the argument. Jesus was not merely a helpless victim of human violence being dragged against his will. The document emphasizes that he willingly laid down his life, stating, "No man takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself."
So suffering has a different purpose.
Exactly. The intense suffering detailed isn't about appeasing a bloodthirsty deity. It is meant to humble the observer. It's designed to show that while grace is completely free to the recipient, it was incredibly costly to the one providing it.
It's presented as the ultimate exchange. The document spells this out really vividly. Jesus bore our sins in his own body. It is a total cosmic swap. Our guilt becomes his wounds. Our moral bankruptcy is met by his infinite capital. He takes the cosmic hit so we don't have to.
And if we accept that this substitution is the core mechanism, we have to move to the next logical step, which is verification.
The receipt.
Yes, the receipt. We've established the required payment and we've established the substitute making the payment. But if you are the debtor in this scenario, how do you know the transaction actually cleared?
Right, because in any real transaction, you need proof.
Yeah.
If I am banking my entire spiritual existence on this substitution, what's my proof that this wasn't just a tragic death of a really good person?
The source focuses heavily on the concept of the completed transaction, specifically the phrase spoken at the crucifixion. It is finished.
The visual contrast the author uses to explain this is just brilliant. It compares the ancient priests to Christ. The document notes that the old priests had to stand daily. Every single day, they're on their feet, offering the exact same repeated sacrifice.
Because the work was never done.
Right. The debt was never fully cleared, so they could never rest. But Christ, according to this framework, offered one sacrifice for sins forever, and then he sat down.
And the imagery of sitting down is profound in an ancient context. You only sit down in the presence of the divine when the work is flawlessly complete. The author uses another very vivid legal image here, talking about the handwriting that was against us.
What does that mean exactly? Like a rap sheet?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
It refers to the moral law, that impossible standard of perfection that gives us the explicit knowledge of our own failures and just stops every mouth from making excuses. It's the itemized bill of our moral debt.
That is terrifying.
It is. But the argument states that this handwriting, this unpayable bill, was entirely taken out of the way and nailed to the cross, blotted out completely.
But again, a completed transaction requires historical proof. And that is where the resurrection comes in. The author argues that the resurrection is logically essential because a dead redeemer couldn't save anyone. If he stays in the grave, the debt crushed him too.
The linkage between the two events is fascinating. The framework suggests he was delivered over to death because of our offenses, but raised to life because of our justification.
Let me stop you there. Justification. That is a very heavy insider theological term. What does that actually mean in practical language? Is it just being pardoned?
It goes a step further than a pardon. A pardon says you are guilty, but you won't be punished. Justification in this legal framework is the judge slamming the gavel and declaring you are entirely innocent and fully righteous in the eyes of the court.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
Huge. The empty tomb is presented as the undeniable proof that the payment for that justification was accepted by the divine court. It declares the victory over death, confirms his identity, and serves as the cleared check.
Okay, let's unpack this with a critical question of application. Because if I am listening to this, I might be thinking, all right, if the debt is entirely paid and it's a completely finished transaction and the check is cleared, does that mean every single person on earth automatically has this everlasting life? Is this cosmic bank transfer just applied to humanity across the board by default?
The source document gives a definitive no to that question. The framework presented insists that this reality must be communicated or preached, and critically, it must be received. The text outlines that repentance and the remission of sins, meaning the cancellation of the debt, must be actively embraced. A person must actually believe and place their trust in the substitute to experience the transfer.
But wait, if they have to believe to activate it, isn't that just a loophole? Isn't faith just the new monopoly money? Like, I can pay with good deeds, so I'll pay with my really strong belief.
That is a very common point of confusion, and the document is highly precise about this distinction. Faith is not a currency. Faith does not complete the transaction or add value to the cross.
So what is it then?
The argument is that salvation is entirely a gift, and faith is simply the open hand that receives the completed work. It contributes zero payment to the debt. It merely accepts the ransom that was already paid in full by someone else.
So it's like someone depositing $1 billion into your bank account to cover your debts. The money is sitting right there. But you still have to open your app and click Accept Transfer. Clicking the button didn't earn you $1 billion. The button has no financial value whatsoever. It's just the mechanism of receiving the gift.
That is exactly the dynamic being described, which leads us to the final and perhaps most disruptive phase of this deep dive. If the payment is completely finished, and it absolutely cannot be earned by our own efforts, what does this mean for how a redeemed person actually lives their life on a random Tuesday?
Right, the result. Because if you truly adopt the worldview that you have been bought, everything changes. The framework points out that you are bought with a price. We talked earlier about redemption being a transfer of ownership. It frees a person from the slavery of their own compulsions and moral failures. But the logic is very clear. It doesn't make you an independent contractor in the universe.
No, you don't just become a free agent. You come under a new master. You belong to the Redeemer. And the implication here is staggering. Yeah. It means that your body, your relationships, your speech, your money, your private choices, they no longer belong to you. They all come under a new benevolent lordship.
Which naturally brings up the massive question of good works or morality. If we are completely incapable of paying off the debt and the debt is already paid, why bother doing good things at all? Why not just live selfishly and let the infinite capital cover it?
The classic objection.
Right. But the author has a very specific order of operations to answer this. Good works are the result of salvation, not the price of it.
That is the absolute core of the theology. You are saved by grace through faith for the purpose of good works. Obedience does not repay the sacrifice. The framework argues that nothing ever could. Instead, obedience is the natural, grateful fruit of belonging to the Redeemer. It's the fruit, not the root of the tree.
This is where it gets really disruptive for you as the listener, because this totally flips the script on traditional religion. Traditional religion almost universally says, behave well so you can be bought, or, you know, behave well so God will finally accept you. It is entirely fear-based and performance-driven.
Completely.
But this document says the exact opposite. It says, you have already been bought. You are already accepted. Therefore, your behavior changes. It's a life entirely driven by overwhelming gratitude rather than the terrifying fear of a cosmic debt collector.
And the author outlines a very practical response for someone adopting this worldview. It suggests starting by simply acknowledging your moral failures without renaming them or excusing them.
Stop saying you're just managing optics.
Exactly. Just own the bankruptcy. Then deliberately abandon all those false payments we talked about. Stop relying on your family background, your perfect attendance at religious services, or your tearful promises to do better next time.
But human beings are going to human. What happens when you inevitably mess up again? Because even if you believe you are bought, you are still going to make mistakes. The framework has to account for that ongoing failure, right?
It does. When past guilt or new failures try to accuse the believer, the document says to return to the legal reality of the transaction. It asks a rhetorical question. Who shall bring any charge against God's elect?
Elect, meaning those who have accepted the transfer.
Yes, those who are under the new ownership. And the answer to the question is no one, because the divine judge is the one who already declared them justified. The transaction is still finished. You don't panic and try to invent a second payment plan. You rely on the one sacrifice made forever.
You don't start printing Monopoly money again just because you made a mistake.
Exactly. Now, the author strongly warns against using this radical forgiveness to protect ongoing deliberate rebellion. The rescue is meant to pardon the debtor, but also to break the power of the addiction to those destructive choices. But ultimately, the driving force of this entire system is meant to be profound gratitude, not lingering condemnation. It is a framework brilliantly designed to completely dismantle human pride.
Because you did nothing to earn it.
Right. If you couldn't pick a single cent of your own infinite ransom, you have absolutely zero room to boast about how good you are.
It is incredibly humbling. So just to recap the massive journey we've taken through this philosophy today, we started with the total bankruptcy of human effort, the terrifying realization that we cannot buy our own freedom from moral guilt with Monopoly money.
Right.
We examine the perfect, willing substitution of a flawless life, taking the penalty of justice upon himself so mercy could be extended. We looked at the absolute finality of the transaction, proved by the empty tomb acting as the cleared check. And finally, we explored the result. A life of grateful obedience. Live not to frantically earn salvation, but because you have already been bought with a price.
It is a breathtakingly comprehensive system of thought. It moves the listener from total inability to total provision, resulting in total transformation.
Which brings us back to exactly where we started. I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over, building on everything we've unpacked today. Think about the profound psychological weight of the human instinct to self-punish. even entirely outside of a religious context, think about what happens when you mess up.
It's universal.
It is. When you hurt someone you love or you deeply violate your own internal moral code, our immediate visceral instinct is to try and balance the cosmic scales. We punish ourselves. We sabotage our own happiness. We strive and sweat and exhaust ourselves trying to earn our way back into good graces.
Because we want to pay the debt.
Yes. Because we desperately want to hand over our monopoly money so we can feel like we are in control of the ledger. We want to be our own saviors. So I challenge you to consider how radical and honestly, how terrifyingly liberating it is to be presented with a worldview where those scales are already balanced by someone else, where you are simply asked to drop your own useless currency, stop the exhausting striving, and have the humility to just accept the gift.